From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast. It's episode 45 for Friday, the 30th of September, 2011. On the show this week...
I'm always amazed by what some prisoners are able to store in very intimate parts of their body.
This week, we'll be knocking on the door of criminology as we talk to David Wilson, Professor of Criminology at Birmingham City University, who helped design and run units for the 12 most disruptive prisoners in the country. Also, Amazon has one of the most potentially disruptive new products in the news this week, a tablet computer costing half as much as the iPad. And have an infinite number of monkeys finally managed to rewrite Shakespeare? In a word, no. But some virtual monkeys may have. All that and more coming up as we explore this week in Wired News. Hey there, I'm Nate Langson. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk, and joining me is news editor Duncan Gear.
Hello.
And of course, associate editor Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good. Have you eaten all my crisps, by the way?
Most of them.
How much hula was in that bag of hoops?
Multiple hula. A pineapple's worth of hula.
It's pretty impressive.
A skirtful.
Everyone who is listening missed a rather in-depth conversation about the foods that we miss, such as Alpha Bites from Birdseye. Anyway, we're not going to talk about food because we are not the food.co.uk podcast. I don't even know if that's a website or even a podcast. We're going to talk about Amazon Kindles. Amazon has announced a tablet, Duncan.
It has.
And how excited are you about this on a scale of 1 to OMG?
Probably a...
Summarize. What have they done?
What have they done? They have launched... A 7-inch tablet, which is running on a modified version of Android 2.3, heavily modified version, and is remarkably low powered but remarkably cheap. It's the Fiat Punto to the iPad's Porsche.
I never thought I'd hear you refer to an iPad as a Porsche.
Oh, it's a nice tablet.
Yeah, well, Amazon's launched this thing. It's going to cost $200, I think, in the US, which is less than half of what the iPad costs in the US as well. And is basically designed. Is it a glorified ebook reader for like graphic novels and media and music, or is it kind of a low cost tablet? Because it seems like both.
It's a low cost tablet. I mean, it's predominantly for media consumption, and not just books. So it also has video streaming capabilities, obviously, and music capabilities. You know, because Amazon's got kind of fingers in those pies very much.
That's the thing. Amazon's got all of these separate media places that, exactly like Apple has, the, you know, with the movies, the music, the games, but really it's all about books.
And it has quite an innovative web browser on it as well, which does some of the kind of processing in Amazon's Elastic Compute Cloud. But at the same time, it lacks a couple of features that are kind of, you know, standard for tablets. It doesn't have a camera. It doesn't have a microphone.
It doesn't have 3G.
It doesn't have 3G capabilities. So it's kind of a slightly odd push, I guess.
But it is $200. I mean, that's kind of the crucial point here, isn't it?
Yeah, that is the biggest innovation in this product. It is so cheap.
Yeah. Well,
that's what I was going to ask you, Liv. I mean, this to me seems a lot like it could be an impulse buy. You know, it's someone who goes out for an iPad and then sees something that does a lot of the same thing for less than half the price.
Yeah.
That could steal some of Apple's thunder, I imagine.
Absolutely. I mean, I agree with Duncan that, you know, things like a camera and a microphone are incredibly useful. But at $200, I mean, it can't be sniffed at. I mean, what's the closest closest tablet within that kind of price range? I mean,
well, there are tablets that you can buy. If you go on Amazon, the website, you can buy these kind of weird no-name Chinese imports for about £100, and they run Android, and they're
even,
awful.
Even some of the big-name tablets are getting down for that cheap these days because nobody's actually buying them.
Well, the closest competitor was actually when HP killed the touchpad, and everyone went out and bought it for £100.
But that wasn't the standard retail price. I guess this has got the pedigree of Amazon, and it, you know, it's Kindles that have gone before it, and the cheap price, which is
ultimately this is not a threat to the iPad in any way, shape, or form. It's a completely different product at a completely different price for a completely different market.
But people who would never consider buying an iPad will now be looking at this and thinking maybe.
I think what this really is Amazon has just released the first proper number two to the iPad. You know, the iPad's never really had... Thanks, Liv. The iPad's never really had a massive threat from any tablet. And this, to me, at least seems like the one that will not beat it in any way, but will sit nicely in second place, I think, if you ask me. Which he didn't. But I'm telling you anyway.
We didn't ask you.
Doesn't matter. But that wasn't the only other thing that Amazon announced, because they also announced two new Kindles, I believe, to replace the current Kindle. And one of them costs $99 and has a touch screen but no keyboard. And the other one costs, I think, $79 and doesn't have a touch screen.
It's an actual book.
I mean, we're talking no money here.
Yeah, one of them is a touch screen. They've lost the keyboard off it entirely, and it comes with an infrared touch system so that you kind of touch on the right-hand side of the screen to skip to the next page and so on and so forth. And there's a few other improvements in it as well. It's the same kind of e-ink display as previous Kindles. It's not a tablet, but it looks like it could be interesting. And that costs $99 for a Wi-Fi edition, or $149 with 3G access in 100 countries.
And that's going to be out in October for the UK as well. That's, I think,
Not the UK for that one. Yeah, the Fire and the Touch aren't coming out in the UK. The only one that's coming out in the UK is the one that we haven't quite mentioned yet, which is costing $79 in the States. And that's just a kind of super budget version of the existing Kindle. It has no keyboard. I think it has a software keyboard instead, controlled by a D-pad. But pretty much in terms of other things, that's it.
Liv, as someone who has never been massively excited about ebook readers, are you now massively excited about ebook readers?
No, I don't think it's possible to get massively excited about ebook readers. I think they're good, and I think they're functional, and I love the way that you can carry loads of books around, but it's like getting really excited about your bookshelf. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah, but I mean, we're talking $89.
Yeah, the price.
That is no money for a device that can do what this can do.
Yeah, it's a fantastic price, but you know, it's not going to change the world.
Liv, still not impressed. Well,
I think ultimately it's early days for the tablet market. Very, very early days. And lots of people are going to make lots of experiments like this. So, I mean, I saw somebody a couple of days back say on Twitter, you know, the best thing to do right now is probably just get a really cheap first generation iPad and wait it out.
Yeah.
See what happens.
It's good advice if you can pick one up. Well, before we leave ebooks entirely, Bloomsbury, Liv, you wrote about this week. They're doing something interesting with ebooks as well. It's been quite a heavy ebook week.
Yeah, they've set up a kind of sort of digital division called Bloomsbury Reader that is selling off a whole load of out of print or books, or books by some of their authors they represent which haven't ever come to print, and they're releasing them as ebooks or print on demand. So they've whacked on just suddenly a whole load of authors with these books that were never going to be printed. You know, they couldn't bank on them being good sellers in print, but they're just whacking them up online, which is exactly what they should be doing. The only problem for me is the price, which at £6.98, which they've said they've done to be just undercutting the average price of a paperback, I think is still way too high.
So what sort of authors can we get here, and how do people actually read them?
The works are largely from a big literary agency called The Rights House, and their authors include people like Charles Dickens' great-granddaughter Monica Dickens, politicians Alan Clark and Ted Heath, poet Edith Sitwell, and V.S. Pritchett. People can get them on, most of them are available on Amazon actually, but they can go to bloomsburyreader.com, and you'll be able to get links to all the places where you can purchase them, but Amazon I think has listed them all first. On the Kindle, yeah.
Well, let's move on. That's enough about ebooks. We reported actually in June earlier this year that ICANN, which oversees the domain names of the world, approved plans to basically let people bid for generic top-level domains. So we talked, I think, at the time about Canon having things like .canon, so they could have instead of canon.com, they could have shop.canon or cameras.canon, something like that. And Duncan, I think this week it was, the Scots have proposed a .scot domain.
Yes, that's right.
It's getting some support.
The non-profit organisation called .scot Registry has been pushing for a little while now for a new Scottish top-level domain, and the Inverness Chamber of Commerce has backed them. And Ed Vasey has been asked to kind of step up and back the bid as well for ICANN to generate this .scot domain name.
I think it makes sense. I mean, we do have obviously .co.uk that represents the whole of the United Kingdom, but I think, you know, having something like .eng maybe for just England and .scot, and I mean, we already have .ie for the Republic of Ireland.
I thought the point is anyone can apply for these.
Well, yes,
anyway.
Exactly.
It's not like this is a particular.
But you know, if Canon can have .canon, why can't the Scots have .scot if they want him to? But then on the other hand, it does make it more difficult to find your stuff.
It does, but I mean, that's what Google's for. I mean, Google has made its entire business really off pointing people to websites that they otherwise couldn't find. And I think, in a way, to have a, you know, something like
I don't know, culture.scot
yeah.
makes more sense than scottishculture.co.uk as just a point of saying this is a Scottish website. I think it makes a lot of sense, and I hope that it's something that can go through.
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, as I say, I'm not particularly bothered. I'm not going to step up and try and block it. If I was a Scot, I wouldn't necessarily be registering one myself. But fair play to them.
If you had 140-odd grand or whatever it is.
Tell you who will want one, though.
Who?
Associate editor Katie.scot.
Ah, although she has two T's in her name.
Yes, that is true.
So she's going to have to pay for her own.
You'll be hearing her shortly in our feature.
Well, we're going to take a very, very short break. And when we come back, it's time for a bit of monkey news.
The Wired 2011 Summit is less than a month away. Don't miss your chance to hear inspiring talks by speakers from Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft Research, IDEO, McLaren, Refugees Reunited, London Serpentine Gallery, and dozens more. For tickets and more information, visit wiredevent.co.uk.
So an infinite number of monkeys, Duncan, they've been hitting the headlines this week, mostly on our site.
They've been tapping at some virtual keyboards and have successfully recreated Shakespeare's A Lover's Complaint.
See, that's the problem I have here, because they're not real monkeys. We haven't created billions and an infinite number of monkeys. It's all in a computer, right?
We have not created an infinite number of monkeys. You'll be pleased to hear.
So they might as well be an infinite number of horses, ducks.
Haven't got an infinite number of any animal just yet, but we're slightly off topic here already.
Yeah.
A coder called Jesse Anderson has successfully generated a few million monkeys, virtual monkeys, and got them to tap out at virtual typewriters. And what he's trying to do is generate the complete works of Shakespeare.
How? What is a virtual monkey? Is it an app? Is it basically a virtual monkey app?
It's basically a generator that generates letters at random, and it generates them in kind of 9-letter chunks. And each one is kind of compared to the entirety of Shakespeare's complete works until it's found to match a particular phrase, at which point that phrase is marked as found, and then they keep going and going and going until every single 8-character chunk in the entire works of Shakespeare has been knocked off.
See, I'm stroking skeptical cat now, because that's not what the infinite monkey theory actually is anyway.
No, it
isn't. The whole idea is that it explains the nature of infinity.
And the 9-character chunk seems to be a bit kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Arbitrary. Anyway,
yeah.
You know, if you did it with 1-character chunks, then you'd be able to, you know, get it done very, very quickly
and
indeed.
Isn't the point to actually do the complete works of Shakespeare in one go? And that is, you know, within the
Yeah, exactly. He's split
theory.
It up into different parts of the complete works of Shakespeare. When we wrote the story about this on the site, A Lover's Complaint had been completed. But since then, As You Like It and The Tempest have all been completed. The entire works of Shakespeare are sitting at 99.996%. With 132 characters left, so it's not going to be long until they finish that.
What's the point, actually? Is it just a bit of fun?
It is. It's just a bit of fun. I mean, it's kind of showing that we have the computing power nowadays to infinitely generate the complete works of Shakespeare, if no actual infinities are involved here.
Don't get me wrong. I'm all for having fun with monkeys. I'm into monkey fun. Like, that's fine.
That's
I'm
okay.
Just curious as to, you know, this isn't necessarily the infinite monkey theory becoming real, is it?
Well, before you pull out your banana, we should move on.
Shall we move on and talk about meat space? Liv, every time you use a word like meat space, I'm instantly drawn to its content. And this involves Disney too. And toys.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. This is a really cool little new toy that Disney's developed called AppMates. It's a series of toys. And what they are is they're little plastic cars. They've done it to promote Cars 2 or to tie in with Cars 2. And you get a little toy physical car. And then you get a linked app that recognizes when the car is sitting on top of the iPad and generates all sorts of animations around it, which is just a really nice mixing of the kind of online and offline, or digital and physical.
So how does it work? The bottom of the cars have a...
Bottom of the car have little metal kind of sensors, and the arrangement of those metal sensors means that the app can recognize which particular car it is. So actually, as you drive the real car across the virtual track on the iPad, if you come across a mirror, it'll actually show you that particular toy car in the mirror on the screen, as opposed to, you know, there's 6 or 7 different options of cars you can get.
It's a really cool use of the iPad in a new way. It kind of reminds me a little bit of there was a great game called iPad Game for Cats, which I downloaded around Christmas.
They and should you put something with metal shoes for cats. Like little capacitive shoes for cats.
You don't need it. The cat, it works perfectly. You put this game on the iPad, and the cat's paw at a little mouse, and it's great fun for adults as well as the cat.
Are you talking about kind of shodding a cat like a horse?
So you could actually, they can maybe leave different footprints or something on the screen. That would be fun.
I don't know if that would go down well with any of the cats that I know.
No.
There is also painting for cats, where cats chase a mouse and then it sort of has little paw prints and paint swipes where the cats have been pawing at the mouse on the iPad.
That is good.
It's pretty cool. So this is great. The Disney Meet Space thing. Is it called Meet Space? It's not. It's called...
No, it's not. They're called App Mates. But yeah, you should go and check them out.
Cool. Some other fun stuff that's been happening in the Science Museum. I think we're about to be able to play a giant game of battleships.
That's right. In the late 1960s, the Science Museum got together all of the best model ship makers in the country. And then over a series of weeks, they constructed, loads and loads of models of different boats.
At least 10.
Ancient Northumbrian fishing boats, all the way up to kind of Britain's first nuclear submarine. Mm-hmm. And they're currently displayed in the Science Museum, but they're going to be moved soon out of the Science Museum to make way for other things. And so as a kind of final bit of joy for them, they're going to be used in a massive, great big game of battleships. And it's going to be quite impressive because some of these models are about 6 feet long and they're in glass cases.
Look at Liv's face.
No, I'm just wondering if you're actually going to be able to fight them and destroy them or not.
I don't think they're actually going to be lobbing bombs at
them. How are they going to get moved?
Well, you just kind of move them around a kind of grid that's going to be on the floor.
These are huge, though. They aren't. We're not talking like 30 centimetres. Aren't they kind of 6 foot long?
Yeah, but you just place them at the start of the game and then...
It's like wizard chess in Harry Potter.
You don't actually attack them.
No, you don't. But it's part of a festival that the Science Museum is going to be holding called Player. And there's going to be all kinds of different games. There's going to be a games jam. There's a thing called the Interplanetary Postbox, which apparently has a miniature gallery inside a postbox. There's an after-hours game called Take Me to Your Scientist, which asks players to defend the museum from invading aliens. It sounds like it's going to be quite good fun.
I hope it's part of their science museum late. They do the kind of late adults only opening.
Yeah,
those are
integrated. It's going to run between the 28th of September and the 2nd of October, which, depending on when you're listening to this, is this coming weekend.
Oh, I think we have to go.
So, you should go down and try it out.
Well, something I'm going to be going to later, well, not later today, but next week, is Apple's iPhone event. They have scheduled an event called Let's Talk iPhone, and it's believed that we're going to see the iPhone 5. So depending on when you're hearing this, it may already be out.
What are your iPhone 5 predictions?
So here's the thing. I think the iPhone 5 is going to be slightly bigger, and I think it's going to have an 8-megapixel camera, and it's going to have iOS 5, obviously, which is the new operating system. But it's not necessarily going to be as kind of innovative, I think, as the iPhone 4 was versus the iPhone 3 or the 3G. But there is also a rumor that a second cheaper iPhone could be coming out, the iPhone 4S, which some people have speculated could actually be an iPod Touch with a 3G SIM in it. So kind of like a tiny little iPad, where you could just do data stuff, things like FaceTime. And we know FaceTime's going over 3G soon as well. So it could be an interesting little companion. But this is going to be on the 4th, I think, of October. And what's pretty cool about this as well is that originally we thought that the event was only going to be in America, and that generally means if there's one in America and not one elsewhere, then whatever they're announcing is only going to be in the US to begin with. But they are doing a UK specific event at the same time. So what we're believing is whatever they're showing off is going to be out in the UK as well. So we could have iPhone 5 just around the corner at the same time as the US guys.
It's Apple Christmas.
It's Applemas. It's Jobsmas. Actually, it's not Jobsmas, because Steve Jobs...
It's Cooksmas.
No, he sits down. It's time to get your cook out.
Well, I know he did, but he still kind of pops back occasionally, doesn't he?
He does. Well, we're going to be covering that, obviously, so we'll be undoubtedly talking about that next week. So I've had enough of talking about iPhones. We're going to move on. And this week in our feature programme, we are going to explore the world of criminology.
David Wilson is Professor of Criminology at Birmingham City University, but was also Governor at Wormwood Scrubs, Grendon and Wood Hill. We talked to him to mark the release of the Season 1 box set of The Killing, about the brain patterns of serial killers, decoding criminals, and the rather unusual places prisoners will hide smuggled mobile phones. Well, David, thank you very much for joining us on the Wired.co.uk podcast.
Katie, it's always nice to talk to Wired. How can I help you?
Well, first of all, I wanted to talk to you about kind of the criminal mind. Now, obviously, you're now a professor of criminology. What would you say is the single most important invention in terms of helping to understand the criminal mind?
Well, obviously, the invention that most people would point to is brain imaging scanning. That's the current research in relation to brain imaging scanning would suggest, for example, that the classic psychopath is going to have a different image from his brain is going to have a different image from the brain of someone who's not labeled as a psychopath. However, with most technology, Katie, what that really does is indicate not an end in itself, but really just simply other questions that we should begin to ask of those images in relation to brain scans. For example, why did the brain develop in that particular way in that particular person?
And how definitive is that technology? I mean, could it really be used to kind of pinpoint who the perpetrator is of a crime?
Well, it's definitive to the extent that, by and large, those scans are done of people who have already been arrested and convicted and often have been in custody for some distinct periods of time. And therefore, unless we started to demand that people in the street were subjected to the same brain imaging scans, we wouldn't be able to predict who might commit the crimes. So all we've got at the moment is a way of telescoping backwards. We now know that the brain images of people who've been convicted of very serious crimes have a different image from those from what would be regarded as normal.
Okay, now on to your other role. You've been a governor at Her Majesty's Prison Wormwood Scrubs, Grendon and Woodhill. And I understand that you actually helped to design and run two of the units for what they're saying the 12 most disruptive prisoners in the country. Talk about technology playing its part in running a prison unit. Is it just cameras and cells?
Well, there would be no cameras in cells in those units. That would be regarded as an invasion of privacy, even if we are still talking about a prison environment. So there would be no cameras in cells, but there would be cameras on landings and in wings more generally and in the prison and throughout the prison. However, there would be technology also in the sense of the biggest cost in prison are staffing costs, and obviously we use staff to unlock cell doors. But technology can also unlock doors instead of humans unlocking doors. So that would be another use of technology within the high security estate. But you know, a lot of Katie, a lot of the technological innovations one used in the kind of prison environments that you've been describing where I worked were much more low tech than high tech. For example, one of the things that I did at Wood Hill Prison, for the two units in which there were 12 disruptive prisoners, was I always had a level of music playing in the background. And that level of music, it was actually the local radio station, tended to mask jarring sounds like doors being slammed, cells being shut. And that tended, therefore, by masking, dulling that sound, tended to make things a little more calmer.
And on to the actual prison environment and the prisoners existing within it. Now, excuse my complete ignorance here, but what technology are prisoners actually allowed access to?
Well, in these days, prisoners would get access to everything from PlayStations in some prisons to they would also be able to get access to telephones. They wouldn't get access to the internet, but in some prisons they would get access to an intranet, which would allow them to develop the skills that they might need to gain so as to be able to become employed when leaving the prison.
So are they allowed mobile phones?
They absolutely are not allowed mobile phones. And indeed, there is a huge market, black market, in smuggling mobile phones into our prisons. because, of course, prisoners want to use mobile phones, they would say, when they're caught, so as to keep in contact with their family, but often they might be able to continue to engage in criminal activity if they are using mobile phones. The key thing about them getting access to legitimate phones in prison, phones organized by the prison service, is that those telephone conversations that are subsequently made are monitored by the security department. Clearly, if a prisoner had access to a smuggled mobile phone, he or she would be able to have conversations that weren't being monitored. And of course, the big debate ongoing in our penal system is whether or not we should have scanning devices that would not only detect where those phones were within the prison, but would also be able to block any mobile calls being made from within the prison.
What's the most ingenious or perhaps odd place that you've ever found a smuggled mobile phone?
Well, it depends how graphic you want me to go, Katie, but...
Go for it.
May I tell you that I'm always amazed by what some prisoners are able to store in very intimate parts of their body. And we therefore had to develop, or the prison services had to develop, what's known as the boss chair, in which a prisoner would sit in, and we would be able to detect if there was any foreign substances, foreign technological substances, in that particular prisoner's anus.
Lovely. Mm-hmm. The last question I was going to ask you is kind of related to the fact that you're helping publicise the release of season one of The Killing. What's the biggest difference between how prisoners are portrayed in fiction, so maybe on TV, and the reality of what you've seen?
The biggest difference between what is portrayed in fiction and reality is, especially in relation to murder, is that in reality most murders are solved very quickly, because usually the perpetrator and the victim are in some form of relationship. So you don't need to be an offender profiler, Inspector Morse, and you don't need to have an understanding of the criminal mind, because usually the person phoning the police to report the murder is the person who committed the murder. That doesn't make for good TV drama. And the second major difference is my specific area of expertise is in relation to serial murder, people who are going to murder time after time after time. Usually they are portrayed in Hollywood or on TV very much like Hannibal Lecter. In other words, the serial killer is going to be some kind of incredible maverick, devilish genius, whereas in fact, in reality, most serial murderers are incredibly banal, and they fit that description given by Hannah Arendt, that when she encountered Adolf Eichmann at his trial in Jerusalem, of being the banality of evil.
Well, David, thank you ever so much for joining us.
Well, you're very welcome, and please ask me again.
Will do. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was David Wilson, Professor of Criminology at Birmingham City University. I'm Katie Scott for the Wired.co.uk podcast.
Katie.Scott there, talking crime. Liv, you don't talk about crime enough.
I don't, but I'm glad I've found out about where people put, which orifices people put their phones in order to get into prison.
If I was going to hide a phone, though, that's definitely where I'd hide it.
Yeah.
On
yeah.
somebody else, not myself. Obviously, I'd force someone else to do that on my behalf. This is getting foul. Let's tell people how they can get in touch with us. Liv, tell us how that Twitter thing works.
Oh, the old Twitter thing. You can follow us. We're on @WiredUK.
And we have a Facebook page, Duncan, that is rather rich with joy and happiness.
Facebook.com/WiredUK.
And if anyone wants to email us using old-fashioned electronic postal services, it's podcast@wired.co.uk. Does anyone have any messages for the end of this show? No?
No.
Liv?
No.
High times. And on that note, we will see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.